Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Just imagine, five times more savings toward that overdue home addition, maybe even an addition on that addition. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Joe Lynham, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 3rd of March, these are the main stories. The number of confirmed deaths in the U.S. state of Washington has trebled to six. Iran is preparing to send hundreds of thousands of people door to door to test for the coronavirus, but that could include the feared secret militia.
We have been told there are 300,000 teams. Apparently, the health ministry is going to get help from the Basij. That's a militia that works very closely with the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps.
Exit polls from Israel suggest yet another inconclusive election, though the indicted Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu might remain in office. Also in this podcast, the Vatican opens up its secretive archive into Pius XII, the Pope who some accuse of ignoring the plight of Jews in Europe during World War II.
I was in there in 1990 and we got very, very limited access. Had I been a Catholic historian, I would have seen more.
And scientists sniff out the reason why dogs have wet noses. We start in the western state of Washington, where the number of deaths from coronavirus has jumped to six. The authorities there are so concerned that the governor has declared a state of emergency, which would allow him to access federal funds and possibly even the National Guard. Nina Shapiro works for the Seattle Times in Washington State, and I asked her what the latest was on the death toll there.
Well, officials had a press conference this morning and announced, as you said, that there are now six deaths. Some of them, many of them, are people who are elderly. The elderly are most at risk, but not all of them. So there was one person in his 50s who died and one person in her 40s who died.
Do you expect more fatalities in Washington State?
Well, that's really hard to say. One thing officials stress is that this is really uncertain right now. We don't know how many cases there are going to be. We don't know how well we're going to be able to contain it. They did say we're moving into a new stage of the disease where they're not going to follow up as intensively on each case, but will emphasize more of a community approach that involves giving people the best information to contain illness.
Washington State seems to have the most fatalities thus far. Do we know why Washington State has been affected?
You know, that's a really good question. And I was asking that to one of the officials there today. And I think there's just no rhyme or reason to it. They say outbreaks will happen where they happen. This is the place where we are seeing it right now. But I think it is inevitable that it will spread throughout the country. And you see that happening right now.
Nina Shapiro from the Seattle Times. Iran is also ramping up its response to the virus, having recorded a 50% rise in the number of cases. A close advisor to Iran's supreme leader, Mohammad Mir Mohammadin, died in hospital earlier today. The country's health ministry has announced a massive testing plan with 300,000 teams visiting every single Iranian home. Kian Sharifi from BBC Monitoring has been looking at the social media reaction to the announcement, but first he outlined the government's plans.
We don't know exactly how many people will be in each team. We just know we have been told there are 300,000 teams. Apparently, the health ministry is going to get help from the Basij. That's a militia that works very closely with the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps.
Not very popular, would I say, with the rank and file?
Not at all. And there are fears amongst them that if an IRGC officer or a Basij member...
Revolutionary Guards?
Yes, if they knock on your door... then how are you going to feel about that?
you might not answer the door.
You might not want to answer the door because it's a scary prospect.
Whatever about the idea of the Revolutionary Guards knocking on your door, what about the medical issue of physically going from house to house? I mean, what if you pick up the virus along the way, then you spread it to...
That is another fear that people have expressed on social media. They think that going door to door will only help spread the virus further and even wider. I mean, as it is, 27 out of Iran's 31 provinces are affected by this.
Now, the government wants to do this to show that it's got a firm grip on the situation.
Yes.
Do the people in Iran believe the government, A, that they can get a grip on it, and B, that the number of people affected and have died from the coronavirus is as low as they currently suggest?
There is almost zero trust in the establishment and in the government. People believe that the number of reported cases are far higher. This isn't just what normal people believe. I think it was yesterday that an MP from Resht, a city in northern Iran, he called the figures, and I quote, a joke. He said these numbers are a joke because where I come from, hospitals are full. And there are nurses and doctors who have been affected by this virus.
Kian Sharifi there from BBC Monitoring. To Israel now, where exit polls following the country's third general election in a year suggest that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appears to have won more seats than Benny Gantz's more moderate blue and white alliance, but not the magic 61 needed to form a majority in parliament. Our correspondent Anna Foster is in Tel Aviv at the Likud party headquarters.
The exit polls, all three of them, are the three different main broadcasters here in Israel, and all three of them give Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing bloc of parties 60 seats. The magic number is 61. But from things that Benjamin Netanyahu said in the run-up to this election, he seems to think that he can tempt an MK away from another party to give him a majority government. Now here, they're treating it as a celebration. You can hear the very loud pop music playing. You can see the flags waving. They're dancing in the hall here. And over there, the stage is set for Benjamin Netanyahu. He'll take to that podium there. We're told by the Likud party that he will be making what they're calling a victory speech. That there's going to be a lot of negotiations, a lot of horse trading going on for him to see if he can get that one extra seat that would give him that Knesset majority and solve what has been political deadlock for a year now. Everybody here in Israel knows that he's going to be a defendant on trial in just 2 weeks' time. And yet, this remarkable election result today, which puts him just one seat short of a majority. The campaign, though, has been bitter. It's been divisive. There have been smears. There have been broken promises. The Israeli President, Reuven Rivlin, when he was casting his ballot earlier, said that he felt shame today, that the campaign had descended into filth. He called it grubby. And really, in many ways, it has been. It has been very, very difficult, very unpleasant. And it's made people here in Israel, frankly, sick of the whole political process. They are jaded. And many people are hoping that, in some way or another, this might be the end of it for the next 4 years.
Anna Foster. The coronavirus is having a very real impact on the global economy. Factory orders from China fell to their lowest level ever last month as plants stayed closed and consumers stayed at home. And now the respected international research group, the OECD, has slashed its forecast for global growth. It says growth worldwide will only be 2.4% this year, down from its previous estimate of 2.9% 3 months ago. Laurence Boone is its chief executive.
First, it's a health crisis. But then it's the containment measures that are being put in place to address the health crisis, which are very costly to the economy. We have quarantine, we have travel bans, we have the suppression of entertainment services and sports. And so it's the supply chain and it's the local consumption.
I asked our business correspondent Theo Leggett whether the OECD figures were their best or worst case scenarios.
It's giving both, in fact, Joe. The title of this assessment, incidentally, is The World Economy at Risk, which, you know, shows it's not pulling its punches. Now, what the OECD is saying is that if things don't get too much worse, and assuming that the epidemic peaks in China during the first quarter of 2020 and outbreaks in other countries prove mild and contained, and we're already really getting a little bit beyond that, global growth could be lowered by about half a percentage point this year, relative relative to what it was predicting back in November.
Down to
2.4%. So that's already a significant drop. That's the base case scenario, but it's also done a worst case scenario. And that's where the outbreak is much longer lasting and more intensive. It's no longer contained mainly in China. It spreads widely throughout the Asia-Pacific region, through Europe, through North America. And it says that would weaken global economic prospects considerably, and growth could drop to 1.5% in 2020. So that's half what it was previously predicting. So it's saying that because this risk exists, governments need to act swiftly, they need to act quickly, and they need to take a number of steps to improve health standards, to introduce anti-infection measures in order to prevent this worst-case scenario from occurring.
I suppose the survey underlines the dependence now of the world economy on China.
Well, absolutely. I mean, China is the workshop of the world because it's a place where you can go and you can buy basic products or you can buy quite complex products, ship them over to North American and European markets, and they will be relatively cheap. And as a result, companies in the Western world have become very highly dependent on China for their supply chains. Now, some of them are trying to diversify at the moment, but that takes time. So the warning from all of this is that some companies have become simply too reliant on China to get what they need when they need it.
Theo Leggett. 2 days ago, the Taliban in Afghanistan signed an historic peace deal with the United States, but they have now announced that they will end their partial ceasefire and resume operations against the Afghan security forces until Taliban prisoners are released. Sekunda Karmani reports from Kabul.
For a week leading up to the historic signing of the US-Taliban deal on Saturday, the Taliban had agreed not to carry out any major attacks. Now, though, the group has said fighting with Afghan government forces will resume, though international troops would not be targeted. Afghan officials had expected the partial truce to be extended. The dispute between the two sides has been building over the release of up to 5,000 Taliban prisoners, who the insurgents say need to be freed before talks with the government and other political figures begin. The government has resisted that.
Sekunda Karmani in Kabul. Still to come in this podcast, the Indian Parliament has been adjourned following chaotic scenes over last week's violence in Delhi that left 46 people dead. Before World War II, the Nazis signed an agreement with the Vatican called the Concordat in 1933, designed to protect Catholics from harm in Germany before the war. Historians have been critical of the then Pope Pius XII for not doing more to protect European Jews from the Holocaust. Some even accuse the Vatican of deliberately looking away. On Monday, we got a first glimpse behind the thinking of Pius XII when his private papers were opened to the public for the first time. Mark Lowen is our correspondent in Rome.
He led the Catholic Church between 1939 and 1958, and his critics say that he was Hitler's pope, that he was silent, at best turning a blind eye to, at worst complicit in, the worst crimes of the Nazis, that he didn't ever publicly speak out against the Nazi crimes against the Jews and against the Holocaust, for example. But his defenders, many of them within the highest echelons of the Vatican, say that he was a quiet man who behind the scenes was managing to save Jews, that he persuaded some religious institutions and convents here to protect some 4,000 Jews, that he had contacts with the German resistance. He was even approached about plots to oust Adolf Hitler, and that this is now the chance to clear his name. Whichever way the truth lies, this is where the record will be set straight, because as of today, dozens of researchers will be allowed into the Vatican to examine all the letters and documents related to his papacy.
Pierre Vickery from our own newsroom team has actually written a book about that era and got a look at the Vatican archives.
For a long time, the Vatican has been very cautious about who they allow into the secret archives of the Vatican. I was in there in 1990 and we got very, very limited access. Had I been a Catholic historian, I would have seen more, but because I was a so-called independent journalist seeking access, one didn't get to see many documents. What has changed now is it seems they're making far, far more material available to all historians.
And why is Pope Francis doing this now, 80 years after the war?
Pius XII has always been a highly controversial character. There are those within the church who would like to make him a saint. Francis appears to be resisting that. There's no doubt that Pius XII was a very important figure in 20th century Europe. And in a sense, people want clarity as to what exactly he did in one of the most difficult times during the Second World War.
So the plus and minus of Pope Pius XII, he signed a deal with the Nazis referred to as the Concordat. Now, the idea of that, I presume, was to protect Catholics in the event of a big European war. He was also accused of not protecting European Jews.
Precisely. The Concordat was, in a way, a business transaction. He wasn't Pope then, but the Pope wanted to protect the interests of the Catholic Church, mainly in Germany, but throughout occupied Europe later. And that was the mechanism that they used. In return, not spelt out, but implied, for keeping quiet about what was happening in Europe, the Catholic Church would get some sort of protection from the Germans.
And could we find out in these records, in these archives, that the Catholic Church, which obviously is represented all over the continent of Europe, quietly looked the other way when Jews were being rounded up and sent to death camps in Poland and Germany?
But that criticism can be made not just of the Church, but of all politicians in Europe. I think it's fair to suggest that pretty much everybody knew, certainly by 42, 43, what was happening in Europe, and lots of people were quiet, including the Catholic Church. The argument the Vatican has always made is speaking out wouldn't have helped those who were being attacked and would have had consequences for the Church.
That's the author and my colleague, Pierre Vickery. Britain left the EU a month ago and must now set about negotiating brand new trade deals with two of the world's biggest trading blocs, the EU and the US. Britain took two strides towards these goals on Monday by publishing its aims from the talks with Washington and by beginning actual haggling with the EU in Brussels. So where does each side differ on the negotiations and how will this pan out? Our Reality Check correspondent Chris Morris explains more.
There's been some pretty tough talk before these negotiations have even started. That's not surprising. There's a lot at stake. In fact, things could well get worse over the next few weeks. There are plenty of gloomy predictions around. Both sides would like to end up with a free trade deal with no tariffs or taxes and no quotas on goods crossing borders. But how do you prevent unfair competition between businesses in the UK and the EU, which could allow one side to undercut the other? That's what's known as the level playing field, and some version of it appears in most trade deals. But the EU's demands in this negotiation are particularly strict. It wants the UK to follow EU rules in the future on state aid. That's things like the amount of subsidies governments are allowed to give to businesses. And it wants the UK to stick close to current EU rules on issues such as workers' rights and the environmental regulations that businesses have to follow. But the UK rejects all of that. Leaving the EU, the government says, means no alignment with EU rules. We will maintain high standards, ministers argue, but they'll be our standards, not yours. The UK says we just want the same kind of trade deal that you've negotiated with other big economies like Canada or Japan. The EU says that's not possible. The UK is a special case because it's much closer to the EU and the two economies are far more intertwined. So now we have both sides accusing the other of breaking promises on a key issue. The EU says it's all about protecting its single market. The UK says it's all about regaining real sovereignty. Now, there are plenty of other difficult issues to negotiate as well. Fisheries, for example, and the role of courts in resolving any trade disputes in the future. So it does come down to an issue of trust, which is really important in trade negotiations. You need to have some confidence that the other side isn't going to go back on its word.
Chris Morris. The Indian Parliament has been adjourned following chaotic scenes over last week's violence in Delhi that left 46 people dead. The violence followed mass protests against new citizenship law, which critics say is anti-Muslim. Romela Dasgupta reports.
The scuffles broke out in Parliament on the first day back for MPs after a three-week recess. Government and opposition members began pushing and shoving each other in a dispute over the sectarian violence. There were calls for the resignation of the Home Minister Amit Shah. After trying and failing to calm tempers, the Speaker of the House closed the session for the day. Meanwhile, fears of further clashes on the streets of the capital have prompted some Muslim residents to move into camps in the northeast of the city. Police say they've arrested 40 people for spreading rumours of further violence, causing panic.
Lebanon is suffering a financial crisis that has been brewing for years. It got worse when vital deposits from Lebanese abroad plummeted. That left the country's banking system in crisis. In response, tight currency controls on the US dollar have been imposed. Withdrawals of only $200 or $300 a week are being allowed. This is a huge shock to a system that has lived on dollars for decades. The effect has been devastating on jobs, businesses and incomes. All this is going on while unprecedented protests against the entire political system have brought chaos to the streets. This report from Sebastian Usher.
A song for a love lost has been turned into a lament for the dollar, the singer asking where, oh where it's gone, as the Lebanese, as ever, resort to humour to tackle catastrophe. Beneath the jokes lies desperation.
In simple words, they stole our money.
There seems no solution in the near future.
In around 1 month, almost everybody will be jobless. It's hell.
That frustration and anger has exploded on the streets, with banks and currency exchanges targeted. Everyone says this is the worst financial disaster Lebanon has faced for decades.
Lebanon is going through not just one, but a series of concurrent crises that have hit it all at once, which is what makes this problem so complicated. So it's a financial crisis, a banking crisis, and a debt crisis all at once, and including that is a currency crisis as well.
Nafez Zouk is a Lebanese economist. He says the effect has already been devastating, as banks have all but imposed a freeze on dollars.
You cannot access your savings. The only way you can is to take them out in lira, the local currency, and then convert them back into dollars at the local exchange shop at a 30% discount. So you basically lose 30% of your dollars that way.
For some, it's too much. A customer inside a Beirut bank rails at a system that's holding his money but won't let him have it. Some are luckier for now, like David, who works in the tourism industry and gets dollars directly from his clients. But he's seen the damage.
Almost 70% of my friends lost their jobs. People are jobless here in this country. We are really in a mess.
Months after they started, anti-establishment protests continue, unimpressed by the new government that is in place and devising a plan with the IMF and outside experts. But time is running out, with major debt repayments due soon. The economist Nafez Zouk believes utter catastrophe can still be averted.
It's just going to be long and painful, and we're going to have to do our best to make sure that it's not the poorest and the most vulnerable that suffer the consequences the most.
But a new calamity has struck. With the blackest of humour, Lebanese are avidly sharing this clip, which calls on coronavirus, which has just arrived in Beirut, to wipe out the politicians they hold to blame for their plight.
Sebastian Usher in the Lebanon. From train sniffer dogs to household pets, dogs are known for following their noses. Their sense of smell is more than 100 million times stronger than humans, and the part of a dog's brain devoted to analysing smells is significantly larger than ours. But recent research has found that dogs also have superpowers when it comes to detecting heat. Stephanie Prentice explains.
Anyone that has a dog or has indeed been greeted by an excitable dog will know their noses are always quite cold. And a team of researchers from Sweden and Hungary started off basically wanting to find out why. It was assumed that it was a way of regulating their body temperature, just like when they pant. But in fact, they found out it's because the dog's nose is actually what they called an ultra-sensitive heat detector. Now, they found this out by training three dogs to choose between two small objects, which were identical except for their temperature. The dogs couldn't see or smell, but all three successfully chose the slightly warmer object. Now, the scientists concluded this is because the noses could detect what they called parcels of electromagnetic radiation. And then when they went on to scan the brains of 13 more dogs, they saw that the parts of the brain that process information from the nose became a lot more active near a warm object.
And why would this be useful to the dogs?
Well, we spoke to a canine behaviour expert earlier who said this trait was likely passed down from the wolf, and it would explain how canines that have impaired sight, hearing or smell can still track and hunt successfully. Now, the heat used in the study was equivalent to a small furry mammal about 1.5 metres away, and it was imperceptible to the scientists, but always identifiable to the dogs. Now, the only other creatures that we know that possess this ability are also elite hunters, and that's the vampire bat and the frankly terrifying venomous snakes known as pit vipers.
The newsroom, Stephanie Prentice speaking to Valerie Sanderson. And that's all from us for now. But there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast, all one word, at bbc.co.uk. I'm Joe Lynham. Until next time, goodbye.
Brought to you by Capital One, where you can open a savings account in about 5 minutes and earn 5 times the national average. Just imagine, 5 times more savings toward that overdue home addition, maybe even an addition on that addition. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.